Please get them. I'm not sure catching me out.
Aha, found you out.
That's next slide.
There's one lady just coming back from.
Okay.
So, how would the. Right, you've got the prices, presumably it's written down what people paid for it. But how would those prices be determined? Was it a sort of question of negotiation and talking to everybody else?
I think so. It's the market. I mean, each individual one would be what someone was willing to pay. And I think it's that part we don't know too much about, is how is information disseminated of kind of market prices. We know because the registers are publicly available, so you know what people are paying. So there's a sense of the market price is kind of what is the recorded price, so the average out of what people are willing to pay at different moments.
So somebody thinking of buying or selling would be able to say, oh, well, so-and-so did this transaction a couple of months ago and paid that much.
From the past average. Some of them are different cities have different practices, but some are restricted at selling at certain times of the year to biannually. So usually we have the biannual recording of the interest rate. That's probably more likely what we have left are the ledgers that are calculating the interest at those moments when they have to pay. So that they're interested, because the government and the communes are interested in the market prices themselves, because if they're coming out of war and the bonds are low, they can buy up debt or they can create a sinking fund. If they're able to raise capital from somewhere else, they can buy at a cheaper rate than the market rate of their own debt market. They can borrow and then pay off debt. It's worth saying here that these forced loans that characterise these three biggest republics, they pay the interest, they don't pay back capital.
Right.
On the forced loans, on the voluntary loans they do. So it's like a perpetual bond, really. You've lent, and for the rest of your life you're entitled to that revenue stream as an asset. And then you can use it as an asset as well, as a way of releasing the kind of capital back if you wanted.
And were these three big city-states, Venice, Genoa and France, were they the first people to think of these financial fiscal systems, or were other people doing? Because it's really it's quite complicated and very sophisticated.
The first to do it on the basis of a loan system, so in terms of the citizen and the government making a loan contract between themselves. Similar time, what's going on in the Low Countries, which, if we're thinking in the European context, these are the two. Well, the Low Countries and the Rhineland, actually. Actually, this is broadly what I don't know if you're familiar with the concept of the blue banana, but if you see Europe from a satellite now, the pattern of where the highest blue lights are coming from is a kind of banana shape that you'd see from London going to the Low Countries, down the Rhineland to Italy, from north to central Italy. And the pattern of highest urbanisation in Europe still mimics this medieval pattern of roughly where. This is from a legacy from the Carolingian period, where the Eastern and Western Carolingian Empire met on the frontier of the Rhine, and the Rhine being a kind of trading. So communication and an access corridor from the Alps going up. So it's these places of intense urban concentration, northern central Italy, the Rhineland, and the Low Countries, that have developed sophisticated urban government. The difference is with the Low Countries and the Rhineland that the powerful cities there do not get the kind of political powers that the Italian city-states grant onto themselves, this kind of pretensions of sovereignty, calling themselves princes. They don't have quite the same fiscal resources, because they still fall within the framework of principalities, the Holy Roman Empire, so they have free status and stuff. But within their own finances, they are using forms of deficit finance. The dominant mode north of the Alps is annuities, so selling an income stream In effect and functionally, they can be very similar. It's just that the principle is different, that it avoids making a loan contract. So people have speculated that the reason that these northern cities do that is you get around the usury controversy because you're buying an income stream based on a real asset, and the revenue is not fixed, whereas in a loan contract, the profit on the loan is predefined. Yeah. So if we want to think about what is usury, well, some theologians are defined, any increment on a loan is usury. Mm-hmm. Oh, then the more sophisticated, increasingly from the 12th century, when they start to think about intention, any loan made with the intention of profiting that receives it, a profit is usury. And then in the 13th century, when Aristotle comes in, they start to use Aristotle's definitions of money is sterile, money shouldn't make money. So this idea of profit itself is a very kind of, it becomes almost like usury. So possibly the annuity scheme and selling revenue, those kind of revenue schemes, was a way of getting around it. Some people, it was a controversial question, but it was one on which there was a papal response, whether it was illegitimate and whether it was usurious, much before anything was said about the Monti. In fact, there's never a papal pronouncement on the Monti. So what some people in Italy tried to do, they tried to say, these loans are basically annuity schemes, because they have been legitimised and defended. Those who are a little bit more interested in the contract, they're not the same. These have their origins in Roman law, contract, the mutuum. And that's a problem, because the loans that are permissible in the kind of the Christian tradition are those, a gratuitous loan, giving, and then, just getting the same back, or if you're thinking of the Gospels, lend, Luke, lend and expect nothing in return. So the very idea of profits a problematic one. I haven't used the word interest yet, because Azzo, the 13th, early 14th, no, the late 12th, early 13th century jurist, he comes up with this term, interesse, as a way of kind of legitimising an increment on a loan. And then so you have this whole kind of literature on what is a legitimate increment on a loan. Some people say, well, it's basically if you're lending to someone else, you could incur damages for lending. There's the risk of not being repaid. So that interest is just covering that eventuality. The other one is idea that comes with it's called lucrum cessans, like foregone profit. That by lending to someone, you face a cost in terms of the opportunity. You could have invested that money somewhere else. Mm-hmm. So what is a legitimate increment on that loan is interest which captures what you could have received elsewhere. Mm-hmm. That's a very famous kind of solution to the problem that comes about in the 14th century by Jean-Pierre Olivi. But it remains a very controversial opinion. He's associated with radical Franciscans, and his ideas aren't that popular and are condemned by the papacy at times. And this idea of foregone profit is also critiqued by certain theologians. They're like, there's no foregone profit because it's an opportunity that didn't actually happen. It's a hypothetical, so there is no foregone profit. But all of these ideas about these affect loans in terms of consumption loans that people make, but they apply to the market in Italian public debt. So from the 14th century, the controversy starts to. We have evidence of a controversy. We know about it because it's evidenced from certain smaller communes request the opinions of kind of key leading theologians and jurists to pronounce using the body of Roman law and using canon law, the law that's meant to apply to church and spiritual matters. Is this legitimate? Does this fit in this this framework? So some of the first controversies that arise are simply, well, if you've been forced to lend to the Republic and then you're getting not just what you lend back but something extra, well, that's profit, so that's not legitimate. So those, some of the early opinions simply condemn it on that basis. Then I'm trying to think, so that's associated with the Augustinians, John Clancock, Guido di Belguardo, say that any right to interest is usury. Gregorio de Rimini attacked those that it says about your intention. If you're lending to the Republic with the idea of making a profit, then what you get back is usury. But if you're being a patriotic citizen and helping your Republic in a time of need, then that's illicit. That lucrum, that profit, is legitimate reward for your kind of patriotic duty. So you can see that they don't want to relax this kind of stricture on usury, but they're kind of opening a way of legitimising it. But even with that framework, think of Gregorio de Rimini, that intention thing, you can see how it's a way around it. But when applied to the secondary market, it's a very difficult one. You're doing your patriotic duty by buying loans off someone else with high yield. So it's the secondary market that becomes the most controversial part. The primary market, the forced loans, more or less, it is legitimised by a range of theologians, Franciscans, Dominicans, Augustinians as a way. They kind of see that you're kind of really being taxed, and this is just a small amount of money that's lessening the blow over time. So it's kind of a compensation for damages that you're going through. And so some of them saw it as compensation for damages, or others saw it as a gift. So it's not profit, it's actually a gift back. This is controversial because it is contractually obliged when you lend to the state that you will get that as a percentage of interest, whereas if you think about the theory of gift giving, it's not that I give you a Christmas present and you have to give me a Christmas present back. There is this element of will the ritual be completed to complete the kind of the ritual of a gift cycle. It's not something that you have to do. So again, that's also a controversial element. Although it does work when you think, well, there is the element of chance. It might be that the Republic won't be able to pay you back. It's not. There is this element of doubt within the contract. And the Republic can always, if it claims it's sovereign, and one of the aspects of being sovereign is that in the Roman law, well, the sovereign is above the law. He is the law. The word of the sovereign is law. Well, then he could just break the contract as well. And that is in case what happens in many cases. If we think of these moments where the secondary value is plummeting, these are often where the government hasn't been able to meet its interest payment that year, or it's had to forestall it, or it's had to tax part of the interest in a way of trying to claw back some money. So you can see these contracts aren't, you know, fixed, set in stone. Then some other theologians legitimise it. Well, they say it's been around forever. We don't even know when it began, this practice began, so it's been around for a long time, so it's therefore probably legitimate. The second one based on that is that it's been around for a long time, and if we look at who's invested in it, it's got to be legitimate. The Pope's invested in it. Kings of Europe have invested in it. Members of the urban elite. Well, therefore, you know, if the Pope's investing in the public, the Pope holds credits in the Venetian. The different popes have held credits in the Venetian public debt, the Florentine public debt, the Genoese. And the Republic's, these public debts and their markets, broadly speaking, unlike later, early modern European public debt, which is open to anyone to buy, these are broadly closed markets between citizens. First, forced loans can only be on citizens. Then the secondary market is a market amongst citizens. So the dynamic of debt finances is much more internal. But it's not only internal, because these republics also use, they gift credits to their public debt as a way of kind of creating kind of alliances. So Venice, for example, gifts credits in its public debt to the little lords who are around, surrounding it in the Veneto. The lords of Padova, the lords of Lombardy. But that's a way of basically tying potential threats to the Republic, tying their material interests into that of the Republic. So if they go to war with the Republic, well then their holdings in the public debt, which are attractive to invest in because they have very high returns, are at threat. And indeed what happens, for example, when Venice goes to war with Lombardy, they seize all of the holdings of the Visconti in the Venetian public debt and just confiscate them. But it can be seen as a way of kind of creating strategic alliances. And all of the republics do this with the papacy as well.
Papacy is an office, or individual popes, individually, acting individually?
Mixture. It's hard to separate the two. So, for example, some of the popes originate from the cities, so that they have. We know that they're interested, and we know that they're friends, alliances that cross alliances have interest in doing that. But their revenue streams also are public revenue streams as well, which are invested in it. What's perhaps key for a lot of the story of the legitimation is that the first non-republic to set up an Italian style public debt based on loans is the papacy in the beginning of the 16th century. So they create this thing called the Monte della Fede, the Mountain of Faith. Interestingly, it's created under a Medici Pope, Clement VII. So someone with ties to Florence. He's the nephew of Lorenzo, the Medici, I think. Nephew of Lorenzo the Medici. He's not someone who's grown up in Florence, so he's not immediately aware of, it's not simply by being a Medici he knows how all financial systems work. He's a cardinal, but his family members, his alliances, his advisors are coming from Florence. These are people who are involved in setting up new fiscal instruments in Florence. They're surrounding him, and I've done a bit of research on the setting up of this. It's quite hard to see exactly where they say they get the model from. They don't really say. But it's a mixture of the Florentine and Genoese system. And interestingly, the preamble for setting up the papal public debt, there is not one reference to any of the controversy, the theological controversy that's been going on for 200 years. It just uses Roman law to avoid the issue. It says, we're at a moment of necessity, there's the Ottoman threat, we're defending Christendom, to defend Christendom we need money. It's true that the papacy are involved in fighting the Ottomans, but it kind of happens not at a moment of heightened conflict. It's during the papacy's wars with the Holy Roman Empire in the 15. It happens the year before the sack of Rome, so in 1527. So it's set up in 26. But you know, you give it a name like the Mountain of Faith as well, and then it seems legitimate.
It's called the branding and marketing, isn't it?
Things all money changes, does it?
Exactly. And what they also do is they use the Genoese model. It's not based on forced loans, because the papacy have, by the end of the 15th century, 16th century, have become not just the rulers of the papal institution, the church, but are the government of Rome now, more or less. There's hardly a separate government. But they can't use this same kind of operations that are used in Florence and Venice, because Rome, in the 15th century, you know, you still have herds of sheep going through. It's very depopulated. It's not a mercantile city. It's still, you know, small population, not particularly wealthy. Or the wealth that's coming into it is coming into the church through it. Envoys. So they just use kind of market operations to raise revenue by selling kind of shares in their public debt based on revenue streams that they're taking from their territories in Emilia-Romagna, Bologna, those areas there. So that becomes a very successful public debt. These public debts that are from the 16th century, which are not based on forced loans but voluntary open market operations, by and large are much more successful. They don't have this 14th, 15th century pattern of always being below par in terms of their market value. See, this is always below 100%. Mm. These ones that come in the 16th century often have market values above parity. So just, you know, they're a secure, safe place to put money, as opposed to necessarily a site of rampant speculation. So the papacy starts this model, and then from the 16th century we see also Naples introduce a funded debt. They weren't able to do it before. Naples is much more of an agrarian economy. The mercantile wealth that was in it often didn't belong to them. It's often their trade and importing was dominated by Florentine merchants, so they didn't have the same resources to tap into if they were using a system like forced loans. But by creating stable open market institutions, they use creditors from outside of their territory to lend to them. And that this is broadly the pattern that, you know, we find these kind of debts across Europe in the 16th century, which is broadly what the Pezzolo article is on. What did you make of the Pezzolo article? I mean, what he was trying to say about this kind of difference between republics and principalities, what's going on in the 16th century.
Very complex, isn't it? Interesting to buy monopolised salt.
Yeah.
Fascinating, isn't it?
Salt's one of the really important sources of revenue in all of the Italian states. Milan, for example, the government has a monopoly on salt. Salt, it's landlocked, so it has to import salt, which is expensive. Salt is required for people's diets, for iodine. You know, you're in trouble if you don't have your salt intake. So what they do by importing it, they then force subjects to buy the salt at a markup, so the salt becomes a revenue stream. And that's how their taxes are often named after the salt. So that's one system. And then the other place is that where the salt's coming in and out, they tax salt duties. Salt is really one of the big revenue makers. And some of the wars between Venice and its neighbours are over salt pans.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and between Ferrara, for example, which you have this area between Venice and Ferrara called the Polesine, these very flat lands, which are very useful for the mouth of the River Po for making kind of salt pans. So some of its wars are there about that, really. Important source of revenue. Pezzolo's basically arguing that the latter history of what's going on here in the 16th century, that there's an increased convergence. The borrowing costs of principalities in the 14th, 15th century is much higher. They're untrustworthy. If you're simply merchants making loans to them, there's a very high risk they can default. So people are lending to them, anything 20, 40%. Interest. By using these systems of public debt and using foreign merchant bankers to manage debts and sell like shares in debts, they're able to bring their borrowing costs down. And broadly what you see in 16th century Europe is a convergence of interest rates between republics and principalities. Whereas in the early Renaissance, there was a marked difference such that principalities and monarchies can simply not fund debt. They do fund debt. They have a floating debt, which is kind of, as they need money, they borrow on the market. They have charge a high interest rate, but it's not a particularly sustainable way of financing the state. Whereas if you're able to borrow at low interest rates and assign income streams to paying that, it becomes a kind of a viable means of financing the state. other aspects. I mean, he discusses some of the issues of republics when they're raising revenue face low information costs. You know, the republican citizens of Venice and Genoa, they are creditors themselves. They don't need to find out who to raise money from. They don't need to. These are people who make money. So one way of seeing why they're able to pay low interest rates is they face low information costs. Whereas in the principalities, also outside of Italy, in the Habsburg territories in Spain, for example, it's Genoese merchants who are brought in to set up the system of funding debt by selling securities.
It's very sophisticated, isn't it, for the times?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in, this is kind of, well, period, you know, we have, like, transactions that, you know, not actually involving money. The transfer of public debt can become a kind of currency if you think about our money, where it says, I promise to pay the bearer 10 pounds. This is the origin.
This is when it started.
Mm. Yeah, we do have some experiments in earlier 13th century Lombard towns where they do use credits to the government as pieces of paper and they are circulating. Oh. So there is a kind of cash money in some of them, but they doesn't last very long.
What surprises me is how, when you compare it to today, how things just haven't really moved on.
Yeah, in terms of the financial bank runs and what the government, some of these governments do in response to them by trying to shore up the capital and the kind of thinking about policy and how one shock in one part of Europe in the 14th century, the loans that have gone bad in England, and then simply the information that they might not be repaid sets off a run on branches in Naples, which then runs all the way up to Italy and causes a crisis all across Europe. And, you know, has big impacts on the actual governance of the city of Florence. You know, the ruling elite were involved in these banking families. Our main historical source for recording all of this, the chronicler Giovanni Villani, is not very good for this period telling us what happens because he's a member of this branch of the bank as well. He's involved in the scandal. So we have a real problem trying to piece together what's going on. And then the person who continues his chronicle, this writing what's happening every year, is his brother, who again is heavily involved. But it's also involved in setting up the new public debt as well, so he's a good source of information. But you see kind of the emergence of new ways of thinking, very quantitative outlook on politics, thinking about power in terms of relationship to money and revenue, particularly in these history writers who are, they're coming from a background as notaries, they're employed in institutions and offices because of their legal training in drafting up documents rather than being clerical historians. So there's a big kind of shift in written culture, and these are people who use vernacular, the language of business. You know, the style of Italian writing, which all this stuff is written in, is called mercantesca. It's a handwriting, that Italic handwriting started. Mm-hmm. It comes from merchants, it's writing quickly, so you're writing on a slant as opposed to kind of, you know, slow Latin ornate forms. Stuff. So it has a huge kind of impact on the one aspect of the Renaissance, a less studied part, because it's one that's not easily subsumed to the kind of what we associate often with the Renaissance as simply a kind of humanist culture going back to classical values in a straightforward way. But it's something Jakob Burckhardt in his book on, has it been mentioned yet in the course? He says it's this other aspect of the Renaissance that there is this humanist part that's about kind of reviving classical ideals and virtue and philosophy, but he also briefly mentions that there's this Venetian way as well, you know, not so interested in humanist culture, but businessmen who are interested in quantitative thinking and writing in the vernacular. But these two things, they intersect and cross-fertilise, especially if we think about Florence, where under Cosimo de' Medici he becomes a big patron of a lot of the leading lights of humanist culture. These people start to legitimate the status of people like the Medici using ideas from classical moral philosophy. People like Leonardo Bruni, has it been mentioned yet on the course?
He was the Chancellor, wasn't he?
Yeah. Not on this course.
Yeah, he was someone who was a Chancellor of Florence, so he was responsible for writing the official letters of the Republic.
What
he
was his name, sorry?
Leonardo Bruni. Have I got a slide on Leonardo Bruni? No. Oh, there we go. Yeah. So this was more of an extra chucked in. But he's one of the leading humanist figures. He produces a new Latin translation of Aristotle's Oikonomica, so the book on the management of the household, where we get our word economics from the Greek oikos. It's about thinking the classical world, it's within the household where lots of economic activity takes place. It's kind of true as well for the Renaissance, where the Medici is a family business. So he produces this new edition, and then he legitimates the accumulation of wealth, because with wealth that's produced, and you know, Cosimo de' Medici, before he comes back to Florence in 1430s, he's the largest creditor to the Florentine state. He's bought up lots of these titles. He does favours to people, because if you can't meet your forced loan obligation, you lose your citizen status. But if you sell it to someone who pays it on your behalf and takes the interest, then you can maintain your citizen status. So he creates these networks of patronage through his credit operations, also financing people's dowries. There's a big explosion in the dowry market and the expenses of dowries, which from the Negemi article as well, maybe you saw how that was used as a way of kind of trying to offset some of the interest payments on the public debt by getting people to save for future dowries. And then accumulating all the interest at the end as one big dowry payment. So we can also think about how that influences mathematics as well, because if you're doing that operation, you rather than pay the interest out every year, the interest is accumulated. So you have compound interest. Compound interest requires more sophisticated mathematics to do. You can do it a simple way, but it's towards the end of this period we start to have manuals that are explaining to merchants
how
you do it, and starting to think algebraically how you represent this. So it's kind of this very practical element of mercantile culture that sometimes is separate from humanist culture. He's kind of explaining this know-how, but this know-how is also being legitimated in kind of higher elite culture, humanist culture, by bringing, reviving classical works to kind of show how they defended this kind of accumulation of wealth. Leonardo Bruni says, "Wealth is indeed useful, since it's both an embellishment and ornament for those who possess it. It's the means by which they may exercise their virtue. You can't do good deeds without wealth." Cosimo de' Medici has a lot of wealth. He's able to do a lot of good deeds.
That's Margaret Thatcher.
It's quite interesting how the church works, in as much as the parish share. So the church has an obligation to give a share of its income to the diocese. So that's almost like forced law.
Everybody has to give.
So that some of it can, quite a large proportion of it can be given to
a common good.
Yeah,
we can see. I mean, these figures, like Cosimo de' Medici, their accumulation of wealth is not separate from their Christian belief. I'm not going to say they're kind of complete pagan, Gordon Gekko type figures, like greed is good, but they do get satirised as that. But there is an important element of their patronage of religious works of art, and I mean it's through the Medici wealth accumulated from let's try and make that full screen. I should have added it.
So we're definitely in a market economy,
partly. We've got to think of a kind of overlapping layers of economy. It's a market economy in terms of these transactions of financial assets. Some of the labour involved in producing, finishing cloth in Florence, which is what it's famous for, is hired labour, waged labour. So there is a labour market in something, but these territories, the cities, don't exist simply in a network of other cities. They also have, people like the Medici also have rural holdings, mm-hmm. where their rural holdings are almost, you know, still run on a feudal basis in terms of the there's labour service, which is there's a lot of transactions as well that happen outside of simply a price system as well. So there's a bit of an overlapping, and they integrate the Italian commercial market system. It allows some of the feudal domain kingdoms to work. You know, you don't have an invasion of the English Crown of Wales without Italian financiers. But they can interplay and interwork with it. It's not that one necessarily simply subsumes the rest.
It's also interesting at this particular time you've got Henry VIII, the dissolution of the monasteries. You're hearing what you've said tonight. His dissolution of the monasteries was really about getting the assets to pay his debt.
That's come
quite clear.
If somewhere has liquid, movable wealth in England, it's going to be those abbeys, you know, those large abbeys.
It wasn't purely based on the religious principle,
was it? That's happening when Clement VII is in, in 1520s, 1530s, and he's someone who seen as slightly indifferent to really understanding the religious significance of the Protestant Reformation. you can see the kind of works of art that the Medici are able to patronise, as Fra Angelico, and that he depicts Cosimo de' Medici. They're showing their kind of role in the civic religion as well. But you know, these are all works of art found if you've been to Florence in San Marco, where you know he had his own cell, and he was very keen to portray this image of piety. But you know, the reality is a lot of the money was made through possibly what could be considered usury or interest or ways of getting around usury. You know, if you look through the Medici account books, you will never find anything simply labelled as an interest or anything like that. Everything is sophisticated methods.
Not much changes.
These are a series of works of art being patronised by the Medici, and then the Medici Palace in Florence, designed by Michelozzo. You know, these are huge, extraordinary expenditures and undertakings that they're doing. Donatello's, David. The Santo Spirito by Brunelleschi. So just there's one way of thinking about kind of how these figures are interacting and how credit and these credit practices do feed into, you know, art patronage and also the formation of political factions. The Medici ascendancy is in the Republic. They don't make themselves princes in 1434. They use and manipulate the system of the Republic through patronage, and the very important parts of these patronage networks are based on lending to friends, taking on friends' loans, and friends being used in this very kind of broad, almost clientelistic kind of sense. I've got a handout as well, sorry, I forgot to give it out, but this is just contains a few. Contains a few quotes by humanists on some of the ways they're thinking about.
You have that.
Coming around. Maybe if I can have one back as well, so I can remember what's on there. But I vaguely remember it's got a few of these humanist kind of laudations, legitimations of public debt. Leonardo Bruni in his History of Florence describing the Florentine public debt as a foundation of the Republic. The Latin fundamentum republica, which is a phrase that comes from Cicero. Cicero's way of saying, Cicero says justice is the foundation of the Republic. Leonardo Bruni takes the phrase and replaces justice with the public debt. It might seem strange, but if you think about the public debt as a system in which preserves citizen patrimony, in a way, wealth without alienating wealth through permanent taxation, you can see that there is this kind of nexus between Ciceronian Republican thought and what Leonardo Bruni is trying to do. And again, here we see a similar thing being written in the Venetian Chancellery, the principal foundation of the state. Sorry, this is me doing something very quickly. So the principal foundation of the state should be there, saying the Camera degli Imprestiti. And then, again, so typo for me, it should be Agostino, not Agostino. Agostino Giustiniani on the Casa di San Giorgio in the early 16th century. He's a humanist bishop. He's saying it was the preservation of the fatherland and the republic. He's reading Machiavelli, who... Machiavelli's taken a real interest in the Casa di San Giorgio. He's saying the success of this credit system and this corporation, it will take over the republic. It's run more efficiently, it's more stable, it will simply subsume the Genoese government, Machiavelli thought. And Agostino Giustiniani, a Genoese, takes up this idea, thinking, saying it's the most perfect kind of republic, this creditor system. And then there's a quote here by Donato Bossi, who's a Milanese chronicler, historian, who, when there's a brief three-year interlude in Milan by the death of the last Visconti, there's no successor. So the Milanese merchant elites try and establish a republic, called the Ambrosian Republic, after their patron saint. And when they set up a republic, one of the first things they try to do is fund a debt. We don't know too much about it because fiscal documents are always the first thing to be burnt. People with tax assessments on their popular revolts targets, so it's very hard to piece together if it was successful. And then at the bottom I've just put two quotes about two different humanists thinking about the problems of tax distribution. Poggio Bracciolini, another very famous humanist who rediscovers lots of classical works in monastic libraries in the north of Europe. He writes this text, De Laude Venetiarum, which is the praise of Venice. This is part of this genre of praise of Venice where people don't necessarily precisely know what Venice is, but they know it's very stable and has lasted for a long time. And here he's saying the Venetian tax system is much better than the Florentine. They have a just way of distributing the fiscal burden. They do it on the basis of the Roman census. We don't really know how the Roman census worked exactly and how it distributed wrong. So he just takes it as a fair and just way of doing it, and basically what he's saying, unlike Florence. And this is interesting because it's after the Catasto, this introduction of a way of assessing wealth that's looking at both liquid wealth as well as fixed property. He's still saying there's problems with it. It's susceptible to partisanship and people's I put the libido there, their desires, their greed, and their arbitrium, their will, their own decision. So it's not set in law. It has this arbitrary element. So he's looking at Venice as a solution to the tax injustices of Florence. He's very bitter. He becomes Chancellor of Florence a bit after Leonardo Bruni, and he doesn't get all the fiscal privileges he was promised. But he was a partisan of Cosimo de' Medici. Cosimo de' Medici funds his expeditions to find all these manuscripts out. And then at the bottom I put Palmieri, another Medici partisan. I don't know, did any of you see the exhibition on the Palmieri altarpiece at the National Gallery? The exhibition was there because I think it got damaged by rain, so then they had this big thing about how it had been restored, but they didn't explain that it was because they hadn't fixed the roof due to funding cuts to the National Gallery. But it was a very nice exhibition, and I think the altarpiece is by Botticini, and it's very nice circles of heaven. Anyway, he writes this work, the Vita Civile. It's a vernacular work trying to bring Ciceronian values into the vernacular and to describe what the duties of a good citizen are and of a statesman. And here he's saying that there's real difficulty when it comes to money and distributing tax. So when you've got to think about tax systems, you've got to think about the classical frameworks of justice, distributive justice, giving people what they're owed. But he's saying, in a merchant republic, every merchant's duty is to kind of hide what they owe. There's a kind of cloak over that obscures this. So it's very hard to actually use the principles of justice. And this, again, is written a little bit after the catastrophe, so saying lots of these problems are still there. And it becomes this kind of compromise that you have to use rough rules of thumb when distributing tax. And in a further passage, you know, it says the Republic might tax too much as well, but then what does it do with that surplus? And there he's saying it should spend it on kind of liberality, it should fund churches, it should fund artists, reinvest in the common good through patronage. Okay, were there any questions or anything generally?
Well, I feel with the readings you gave us and the amount you've taught, I understand a bit more. Quite a lot.
Yeah, very interesting.
Yeah, not an area which I've known much about.
And the whole social context of how the Medici came to power, just
incredible.
By like being the people on the spot who had the most money at a time when there were wars.
Yeah, through being papal bankers, they just had that little bit more resources than everyone else in France. Yeah. That is probably what was key for kind of securing their return. And forging alliances outside of the city as well with other powers in Italy who come to their aid when they're in this moment of crisis. Eventually filling the papacy as well.